The Clare Byrne Show on News Talk
with Aviva Insurance.
30% of us in Ireland have food intolerances, with sensitivity to food on the increase in the Western world. So how do you know if something you eat is causing you a problem, and how do you get it properly diagnosed? Well, dietitian Sarah Keogh is with me here in the studio. Hello, Sarah.
Hi.
It's on the way up, food intolerance?
We're definitely seeing an increase with it. I would think part of it is people are recognising it, that in the past people would have sort of put up with a bit of a funny tummy and things like that, whereas now they're kind of saying, actually, I'm not putting up with it. So you can have intolerances that range from sort of mild to really substantially impacting your life. Mm-hmm. But we are definitely seeing an increase, especially in things like celiac disease is definitely on the rise.
So mild would be what? A gurgly tummy?
Could be something like that. With most food intolerances will be focused in the gut. So you might get someone gets a bit of bloating if they eat. You know, people go, if I eat a big bowl of pasta, I'm a bit bloated afterwards. And it's not particularly affecting their life, so they get on with it. And the thing about food intolerance is the vast majority of them are not harmful in any way, that you might feel uncomfortable, but there's no actual damage to the body happening.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, it's more, you know, it's a bit like choosing, saying I'm going to have this pasta and be bloated and that's okay.
I'll get over it. Yeah. So then on the other end of that scale then, what does it look like if it is really a big problem for you?
Where we might look into is something, for example, like celiac disease, which technically is not a food intolerance. It's an autoimmune disease that's triggered by gluten. But for those people, there's very serious long-term and short-term consequences with it. So you get malnutrition, poor growth in children, but you can also get osteoporosis long-term. It causes infertility. It can increase the risk of miscarriage. So in that case, they have to be absolutely strictly gluten-free. But for other food intolerances, for example, like lactose intolerance, a little bit of lactose is going to be fine.
Mm-hmm. So, and there's a difference as well between a food intolerance and a food allergy.
Yes, very definitely. So an allergy is where your immune system is very much involved, and that's, it can range everything from what we tend to see in the headlines, which is the anaphylaxis if someone, for example, has a peanut allergy or an egg allergy, through to things like skin rashes and hives and things like that with it. But it's a totally different mechanism. And if you have a food allergy, you have to avoid all of the food. Even a tiny bit can trigger. Whereas with a food intolerance, you can usually tolerate a little bit of the food.
So how do you find out for definite that you are intolerant of something?
Well, the first thing I would say is you will have symptoms. You know, when food intolerance first kicked off as a bit of a fad, maybe 20 years ago, people used to come into my clinic going, oh, I want to find out if I have a food intolerance. And I go, well, what symptoms are you having? And they would say none. And I would go, well, then go home. Because if you're not having symptoms, and I'm not even smart, sometimes people think, well, maybe I am. But what you're looking at is, do you have symptoms? If you do, your first stop is your GP. You're going into your doctor to make sure there's nothing else. You can't assume it's a food intolerance, because it could be so many other things, and especially gut things. Like 24% of people with lactose intolerance are actually celiac. So you can't just go off the milk. You actually have to get a further investigation. So it's really important that your GP checks you out. If you've had all the tests, you've had, you know, the endoscopies and you've had all the tests and everything's coming back and they're like, you know, it looks like it might be, for example, irritable bowel syndrome or a food intolerance, your next step is to see a registered dietitian. And it's important that you check that registration, the CORI registration, because anybody, as we know in Ireland, call themselves some sort of expert in nutrition. So it's important to get really proper advice. So your registered dietitian, your GP, can refer you, or you can go yourself, and they will be able to look at symptoms and then look at things like elimination diets to actually mm-hmm. check.
So you have to go in and investigate this.
You have
to
go and find
work.
A little bit of work. It's, you know, and the thing is, like, everyone comes along and go, oh, I'm feeling sick, well, give up wheat and dairy. And you're like, actually don't, because particularly if you're celiac, if you give up the wheat and then later get tested for celiac, that test will come back negative even if you are celiac. So then it delays the whole diagnosis all over again for you. So it's really important to check with your GP first, then you see your registered dietitian. What you're going to skip are food sensitivity testing or food intolerance testing. And these get very, very heavily marketed to a lot of people with food intolerance. And what they tend to do is they might take a hair sample or a finger prick of blood or something like that. And people come back with lists of things that are in the red or in the green and so on. And the problem with these is that they don't actually detect or rule out food intolerance. But people end up cutting out huge numbers of foods completely unnecessarily.
So they don't work, is what you're saying?
Essentially, what they will tell you is what you've eaten recently. So usually in the last 3 to 4 weeks. So the things you've eaten the most of in the last 3 to 4 weeks tend to turn up as high on these tests.
Because they're in your system.
So just in your system. So we actually find a lot of them might be testing a thing called IgG, and this actually shows you're tolerating the food, which is quite funny. Now, the problem is, because they don't rule out or rule in food intolerances, you can accidentally cut out something that is causing you an issue. But you end up cutting out 10 foods instead of one, or something else can be missed. So what we would see, particularly working with the Celiac Society, is someone who's been off gluten for years might mm-hmm. have these tests done, but the gluten comes back in the green because they're not eating it. And they go, oh, my celiac is cured. And you go, no, it's not. Just these tests just pick up what you've eaten recently.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really important that, you know, you can leave those tests alone if you want to and just go straight to your dietitian.
So it's trial and error, really. That's the only...
It's a little bit trial and error, but it's educated trial and error. So as a dietitian working in gut for a long time, you get familiar with symptoms and you get familiar with how different foods react with that. And very often, you know, from the big part is actually a good detailed history of the patient, like what are the symptoms, where did they start, how's that looking, what specific symptoms are you getting, going through all of that. From there, you can usually make a well-educated guess as to what it is and then go through. Or what sometimes happens is I'd see a lot of patients and their symptoms are just so, for I don't have a better word, wrong. I'm often referring them back to the doctor to have a different test or to check something else with that as well.
Okay, let's have a look at some of the messages coming in. I can sometimes get a lactose intolerance. Sometimes it can really upset my stomach. But because it's rare, I don't do anything for it. Am I doing myself any damage? Now, I don't know how that person knows that they're lactose intolerant.
Do you know, most people who are lactose intolerant do know it. It's quite a quick response. If you're someone who's lactose intolerant and you say drink a glass of milk, within about 2 hours, you're going to have bloating. And I can only describe as an extraordinarily large amount of gas.
Uh-huh.
I find most, if I've ever had patients come in to me and go, I'm lactose intolerant, when we check them, they usually are.
Right. And are you okay with that person saying, it's rare, so I don't do anything for it?
What I would do is, it's rare, probably depending on how much they take. The one thing I would say is rule out celiac, because celiac disease causes a temporary lactose intolerance that mm-hmm. you do need to check.
So this next person gets a scratchy, itchy throat and tingling lips when they eat melon. And they want to know, is that an allergy?
Sounds like it. I would definitely take that to your GP for just get checked up.
Or just don't eat melon.
Well, it's that. But you'd kind of just double check in case sometimes you might be reacting to something in melon that might be in other foods that you do need to be careful of. So I would definitely be checking into the
GP. Okay, because
that.
You might need to guard against coming in contact with that.
Possibly. Now, it's unlikely if that's your consistent and repeated response, but I would always just check, bring that one to the doctor.
Can you get an over-the-counter celiac test?
No, you cannot. There are some marketed, but they're not terribly accurate. So what they would do is give you a clue, but you would still need to go to your doctor. And one of the things even about the blood tests for celiac with your doctor is that 3 to 10% of celiacs will be negative even on the doctor's blood test. So sometimes you are going to need to have the biopsy done as well.
Okay. What's the most common food intolerance that you come across?
The most common food intolerance is going to be lactose would be the most common one we see, followed then by gluten. But that's more, as I said, it's kind of more, it's the celiac side of things that we would see.
And you mentioned egg there. Where does that
So egg would be one of the most common food allergies. So
okay.
That's where it would be.
And that rules it out completely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So, and if you're lactose intolerant, no milk, no cow's milk. Is that how you fix that one, or how you address it?
So basically, what you're doing is lactose. You don't need to completely remove lactose. So ordinary cow's milk, instead, you'd use lactose-free milk, or you can use like a soya milk mm-hmm. instead. But you can have cheese and you can have cream and butter. So it's not that you need to completely avoid lactose. It's just taking the dose down.
Oh.
And yogurt sits in the middle, that it has less lactose because it's fermented. But some people can tolerate a little bit more yogurt than others. So it's quite individual. And it's actually no harm if you do have lactose intolerance to have a little bit of lactose every so often. It actually reduces symptoms if you get exposed to a large amount.
Have a little bit.
No, a little bit.
Yeah, but be careful.
Yeah.
Okay, it's fascinating because it sounds like it's very finely balanced, you know, what you need to do and what you don't need to do. And you need to avoid cutting out food groups, which I think what you're telling me is some people are doing that unnecessarily.
Well, this is it. And if you do something like cut out dairy entirely, you lose your calcium, you lose iodine. And, you know, people will say, well, I get calcium in other places. Very rarely do I see someone who doesn't take dairy who's actually hitting calcium targets. People have this belief that you're getting it out of green veg, but you'd have to eat 120 bags of spinach a day.
Yeah, we're not
to get your
that.
Calcium. And I'm not recommending anybody does that. So it's if you're lactose intolerant, I'd still check in with your registered dietitian. Just double check, make sure you're taking, especially for kids. We have a big thing about taking kids off dairy. We really need to stop doing that unless they actually have a genuine allergy or a real need to do it.
Okay, because it brings all sorts of benefits. Yeah. Sarah, thank you so much for coming in. That is dietitian Sarah Keogh. Now, my next guest is a psychotherapist, a broadcaster and a former professional footballer who's been working with young people on mental health, masculinity, consent and relationships for many years now. Rishi Sadler, thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, Claire.
And add to all that list someone who has a cough, right?
Yes, a tickly cough. The last thing I should be doing is being on radio.
You're very welcome. It's great to see you. I'm struck by you saying that we as adults have decided to hand 11-year-olds the entire internet.
Yes.
And we think that that's going to be okay. It kind of scares me, you know, as the mother of children who are around that age. But it is sort of what we've done, isn't it?
It is. But I think the good thing is we're starting to realise now the impact of that. We know the effect of it. There's lots of research. There's lots of data out there where we can now kind of be informed now on our decisions.
Mm-hmm.
If we give an 11-year-old internet access and we don't supervise them, When they hit 12 and 13 and 14, it's a stage of life where they're really curious to learn more. They're little sponges. They want to know how to behave. They want to know how they should behave in the next couple of years. And whether you want to look at documentaries like Manosphere or lots of other material that we know is online, it's not a great place for us to be is to lead with giving social media access to youngsters without knowing what it is they're looking at.
You mentioned the Manosphere documentary, the Louis Theroux thing, which we talked about a lot on the programme last week. But the one thing, having allowed it just to percolate in my head over the weekend, the one thing I took from it, one of the things I took from it, is that those guys are targeting 13-year-olds. Mm. They're not interested in people in their 20s. They're targeting kids. They're chasing them down.
And what, like, you're right, there's so many different things you could take from that documentary or the wider discussion. But what it kind of tells me is there are lots of young people out there, young lads, who are open to being guided and are interested in being supported and are kind of stepping into this world, acknowledging that help from someone older who is more experienced and knows a little bit more about the world is something I should look for. And so I think I kind of take all that and go, right, well, let's be that. Let's come up with some alternative and not sit here with our head in our hands go, oh my God, the world has gone to pot because of the Manosphere. Just go, well, loads of young lads are, and young girls are ready to hear from us and want to be guided.
Exactly. So let's come up with something. So glad you said that. Yeah. So let's replace those people on the internet and be the guide. Yeah. And stop, can I ask you about this? Talking to our children as though they're all like Andrew Tate or want to be Andrew Tate. Yeah. You know, you're doing this and you're watching that. That's just not the way to do it, is it?
Well, it is the way to do it if you just want to feel good about offloading whatever anxiety you have.
Yes.
But if you want to engage a youngster in a conversation, you don't have to be a parent to know this. You don't have to be a teacher to know this, but you just have to remember being a young person. An adult who lectures you or wags their finger or is telling you their tuppence about your world, you're waiting for them to shut up so you can get out of the conversation.
Mm.
It's not a person where you're going to go, okay, I can't wait to let this person in on the real world that I'm in. So I kind of much prefer, rather than blaming young lads for being led in certain directions, criticizing them for being excited or curious by sex or want to know more about relationships, is just to create the conditions where they can talk about what it is to be them. What are they learning? What are they seeing online? What are they experiencing in the real world? What are the difficulties? What are the challenges? Where are the opportunities? And is there a way we can facilitate a conversation among loads of other people the same age of you so you can learn off each other? And we can then, as adults, step down from this overwhelming pressure that we put ourselves under going, what do we need to say to them to change the direction, to make all the difference, to change their way of thinking, like as if there's some magic phrase or some story or some memory we can share.
We all feel that pressure.
We do.
We have to fix this. We know they're coming for the kids and we have to be there and we have to provide the buffer. So how do we do it? Well, we do it by warning them, giving out to them and telling them that they could turn into terrible people.
So one of the significant changes, which to me presents a massive opportunity in this area, there's a shift in the education world now in the landscape in this country. The topic SPHE is now being made mandatory in schools in fifth and sixth year.
Mm-hmm.
SPHE is where sex ed is and health and well-being and all the stuff about being a young adult. It's now mandatory. And I can use a phrase like, this is a great opportunity. But the reality is for a lot of schools, they're sitting there going, well, this is a problem. Where are the resources? How do we support teachers to deliver this? How do you put a lesson together? How do we interpret the curriculum? And where do we start? So I spent the last year developing an online platform, which is now available, which is the solution for all of that. So what I've done is interpreted the curriculum, put together a load of micro modules, learning units, totally in line with what the Department of Education have told schools they have to deliver. But in a really different way, I've sat down and filmed those discussions that I've just talked to you about, where I ask young people to talk about the world in which they're living.
Mm-hmm.
And those, all that footage is clipped into little 5 or 6, 7 minute videos for teachers to play in a classroom.
Okay, so it's not you're not training teachers using these videos. You're saying
this is a resource.
Walk into your classroom and press play.
This is a resource with lesson activities, lesson plans, a selection of multimedia original footage where they can select what is most suitable for my teaching style or where my students are at, what are the topics they need to learn about and what approach would work best?
Mm-hmm.
Is it the discussion-based exercises? Is it the more creative ones? Is it to watch videos of teenagers talking, or me in a conversation with a subject matter expert, or me in a conversation with someone in the public eye who's talking openly about an experience? So,
and schools are already using that, like not in a form, it's not part of the curriculum yet. I know that's your hope, but schools are using that resource.
Yeah, well, we kind of wanted to pilot it to get a sense of what it's actually like to use it and to get input from loads of teachers and how to improve it. So 42 schools are using it at the moment, and the feedback we're getting has been great, that the videos in particular are getting loads of engagement from students, which is what we want.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to hear back from students to go, well, how can we create the conditions in a classroom that will get student voices to lead conversations? So like an SPHE teacher is a facilitator of education. That's the description of their role. In other subjects, they maybe have to adopt more of an expert role. There's a right and wrong answer to questions because there's a test coming up and you need to know certain things or know certain phrases to get certain results. SPHE is different. It's about talking. And if we set up a classroom where students can feel like they can talk and they learn so much more from one another than they ever will.
Yeah.
If it's just the adult in the room telling youngsters mm-hmm. what the answers are to tricky dilemmas.
Well, I would guess most adults, Richie, are terrified of talking to teenagers. Were you when you started this?
No, my first steps into classrooms, I'd say 10 or 12 years ago, I was training to be a psychotherapist. And a big part of that training focused on promoting self-care. I think stress response was the name of the module. And for really obvious reasons, they were like, if you want to work in mental health, or you want to be a psychotherapist and you don't look after yourself, you'll crash and burn.
Mm-hmm.
So self-care is vitally important. And they suggested or invited us to try loads of different things that you might do to mind yourself. And I remember at the time thinking, this would be really useful to know if you were a teenager. Like, this stuff is transferable to everyone.
The self-care skills.
It's not just trainee psychotherapists who could benefit from looking after themselves. So there was a lot of talk at the time about, like there still is, about how do we get men to talk and what's going on in the lives of young lads. So I went back to my all-boys secondary school and did modules in mental health and modules in sexual health. And I just loved it. Like mm-hmm. I just loved, quite apart, forget whether you think those topics should or shouldn't be in schools. Like, I just loved being the one in the room. And that's when I started to realise the most benefit that these students will get is if I'm doing the least talking and encouraging them to be the ones contributing.
Yeah.
And not shutting it down, saying, sorry, mate, that's a wrong answer. He's got the right answer. It's like, is that how you see things? Anyone see things differently? Okay. And what would you say to
just
someone?
Just facilitating.
Just facilitate.
And tell me, are the old tropes, girls want to talk, boys don't? Is that true?
I actually had a filming weekend there just gone and I asked the youngsters, again, this is my whole approach, it's just to shelve the question back to teenagers. And I said that to them, I said, what do you think the differences are between you all? And the girls were sitting there thinking, I don't think the boys have what we have in terms of friendships where we can just let it all out. And the girls were talking, you know, I can ring my mates and we can cry and I can actually tell them when I'm, you know, annoyed with them and we just, and that's what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, I have male friends and I just know they don't do that. They can't do that. And I turned to the lads and was like, lads, what do you, is that the case? And they're like, yeah, like we just wouldn't see that as an option.
Mm.
I've never cried in front of my friends. I would never tell my friends there's something wrong with me or something I'm finding difficult. And I was like, well, who do you tell? What do you do with it? And they're like, we just don't. I was like, girls, like, what do you think, having heard the lads talk about that? They're like, I feel kind of sorry for them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got the lads to go, well, girls, what's it like for yous? And they were like, well, you know what? The one thing that's rarely discussed is, they were like, can I use the word bitchy? Because we were being filmed. I said, go on. I said, well, I think I find, and she looked at the other girls in the room and she was like, the most difficulty I've had has been from other girls. And the girls were all nodding at each other. And then they started to elaborate on what the communication, sometimes really subtle and sometimes loaded and sometimes quite obvious and sometimes quite excluding, the conversation online or offline or in the real world between girls. And they found that really challenging.
And
they
that,
found that the most challenging thing.
And for the boys, they don't really have experience of that either.
No, we were all looking at each other going, the lads especially, the girls were like down to things like punctuation being in a message or not, or an emoji being in a message or not. And the lads were all looking at the girls going, "I've never observed punctuation in any message I've ever received." And the girls are looking at them going, this is the world we're in. So what I liked about that is I didn't have to do any work in that conversation. I didn't have to go into the girls and let them know I understood them.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have to go into the boys and let them know I know what it's like to be them, because I was their age at one stage, that awful phrase that loads of adults use to teenagers. I just sat there and said, "What actually is it like?" And then I just shut up. And then the boys and the girls talked and they all learned loads about each other. So my aim with this platform is that that kind of an interaction will be recreated in classrooms all over the country, because the teacher will no longer be under pressure to be the one who has to know everything. They're just the one that has to facilitate students to talk about what it's actually like.
Was the fear in those conversations, and I'm sure there's a nervousness amongst the individuals in the group that they might reveal something that is used against them when the class is over. I mean, you have to guard against that as well to protect people, right?
Yeah, so there's, and I used to do that as well when I was in classrooms. So on the one hand, I'd say, lads, this is an open environment. Like, I'm not going to send you down to the staff room if you use bad language, or if you say certain anecdotes, we'll be okay. And obviously there's limits to that kind of confidentiality. But I would always say that to them as well, but let's box clever here. Like, there are 25 other people in the room, so whatever you say will be heard. So choose what you say. So there's kind of getting the balance between the two. So.
Because you want to protect them afterwards when they leave that conversation, that they're going to be,
so again,
going to be
like,
okay.
I think a lot of conversations in SPHE aren't designed to get teenagers to disclose personal things.
Mm-hmm.
You can do it in loads of ways where no one is vulnerable and no one is exposed. You give, I give examples from my therapy practice over the years. Here's the person I dealt with. Here's the issue they were facing. And that can be material then for a discussion. Or here's a scenario, there's the 8 possible solutions. Rank them in the order that you would think the best or worst for you. And they'll very quickly realise loads of other people see things differently to them.
And listen, we're coming up to the end now, but can any of us access this? Or
yes,
is it
just Let's Talk SPHE. Our website is up and running now, so go on that and all the information. It's schools can pay for it through the school book scheme, and it'll be in classrooms from September.
We all need it. We all need it, Richie. Thanks so much. And we'd love to see you again soon. That's Richie Sadlier. Thanks to everybody who got in touch with the programme today. The team, Hugo De Silva on sound, producers Dee King and Lena O'Toole and Alex Russo. Research by David O'Connor. Our broadcast assistant is Anne-Marie Kane. Andrea's coming up next. I'll be back tomorrow at 9. Have a great day.